The Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference, co-sponsored by the Institute for Anarchist Studies and Institute for Social Ecology, aims to provide a space in which to re-examine and reinvigorate the social and political tradition of anarchism. The mid to late 1960s witnessed an explosion of militant compositions by jazzed artists as well as direct actions. From Cecil Taylor and Charles Mingus's attempts to create a counter-concept to the Newport Jazz Festival to Max Roach's zapping of a South African benefit concert, jazz became the form and soundtrack of black liberation and revolution. Post-pop also became the siren call of the students during the May-June uprising. This workshop, lecture, listening party explores the legacy of post-bop jazz and R&B free jazz from the militancy of Archie Shepp to the Afrofuturism of Sun Ra and John Coltrane to the current musings of anarchist jazz musician Daniel Carter. The presentation will also explore how musicians seek to construct autonomous spaces for individual artistic expressions and collective liberation. Kazembe Balagun is a cultural historian educator in New York City. He has taught at the Brecht Forum and is currently working on a collection of essays titled Queering the X, Malcolm X, James Baldwin, and the Third World.
I was tempted to kind of do this Miles Davis style and do the lecture with my back turned to the audience, but I was advised by the facilitators that it wouldn't be in the spirit of this great conference that we had.
You probably had a microphone too.
Huh?
You probably had a microphone.
Yeah, exactly. He probably had a microphone as well. You know what I'm saying? So the name of this workshop is Freedom Suites, Post-Bebop Jazz, and the Anti-Authoritarian Imagination. What I'm going to kind of do is, what at least I've been instructed to do is do a 30-minute solo, followed by collective improvisation. So, but I think there's room that we can break into that later on. And I just sketched a few notes, and hopefully, these ideas can kind of like provoke some discussion and a good jam, all right? And I wrote down the quote from Cecil Taylor, who's a free jazz pianist: "The audience must be as prepared as the performer." So I expect, I know all you guys are probably lovers of music. Any musicians here? I know we got Max Roach over here, percussionist. What do you play?
I play drums.
You play drums as well? You guys should get together. All right, cool. All right, so I'm going to start off a little bit talking about one of my favorite playwrights, who is August Wilson. And August Wilson has a play. He's doing this cycle of African-American life in the 20th century, and he's already produced about 5 plays. And one of his earliest plays, which is one of my favorites, called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And and this play takes place in the 20s, and it involves, how many people are familiar, everyone's heard of Ma Rainey, right? The African-American woman blues singer. Well, she was a very famous blues singer who came out with records on the OK label, which was a race label, because it actually separated the labels from like white music and black music. And OK, was considered, one of the premier like black labels. In fact, if anyone's familiar with the Roots, everyone knows that they have OK Player. Well, it's actually a derivative of OK Race Records. In any event, in this play, it takes place in the studio. And everybody's in the first 2 acts, everyone's waiting for Ma Rainey, including the two producers who happen to be white. And they're complaining because they realize, they're saying that, she's always late, and because she's late, she's costing us money. And this is unbelievable. And the musicians are waiting. They're having talks amongst themselves. And finally, Ma comes in with her entourage, saying very flamboyantly and saying, hello, fellas, how you doing? And so they're like, come on, Ma, come on. We got to get this thing out. We got to press the record. We got to sell it. And we got to go on. And Ma's like, chill. You know what? I don't do anything without my Coca-Cola. I need a Coca-Cola. If I don't get Coca-Cola, there ain't going to be no singing going on right here. They're like, damn! All right. So the white guys are running to get the Coca-Cola, right? All right, they come back, right? And Ma's taking a sip of time to sip in the Coca-Cola. you know, just chilling, talking, you know. I need to refresh myself. That's what she's saying, right? And then what happens is they're producing a song. You know, it's called, I think it's called the Black Bottom Stomp. And this is actually in real life. Her nephew, Sylvester, appears with the introduction of the song. But Sylvester has a speech impediment. So they have to go through like about 3 or 4 takes before Sylvester can read the beginning. And the producers are angry. They're pissed off. They're like, you're costing us so much money. You know, they're like, ah! You know, but Marini's like, listen, how do you expect my nephew to get over his speech impediment if he doesn't practice? And this is the best practice there is. So finally, they get it done, and they're listening, and you know, and she does her thing. She does the Black Bottom Stomp. The reason I kind of relay this play is because it really sticks into the idea of time within jazz, and how within the music, there's a different type of time. Within the sort of capitalist framework that we're working in right now, this is what we call Taylorism. You know what I'm saying? Time is money, money is time. I don't have time for that. But when you're jamming, things are timeless. You know what I'm saying? You can't really put a value on that. All right? Can you guys dig me? You guys there? Okay, cool. All right. So that's one of the major themes I'm going to be dealing with in terms of talking about the post-bop jazz moment and free jazz moment of the music moment. Because one of the major facets of jazz and the blues, you know, in all African-American music is a reaction to and from our experiences coming to this country as enslaved people and our resistance to that on multiple levels. One of the interesting things that occurred during the process of enslavement was that there was an attempt, particularly in the United States, not so much in the Caribbean, because the Caribbean had their own, what they call, what Winston James calls majority consciousness, where, you know, they had like maroon communities, what they call quilombos or maroons, where they can maintain their Africanisms. But particularly in this country, there was what G.M. Gonzalez called a scripting process. And I would suggest anyone to read the book edited by Lewis Gordon called Black Existence. There was a process of scripting, or the process of scripting away your cultural identity in order to become enslaved, right? So one of the major facets of this scripting process was the removal of the drum. The drum was a very important instrument in terms of African-American worship, in terms of African worship, in terms of our sense of being. And the early colonists realized that because the drum was used as a messaging device for rebellions, for ceremonies, for everything, you know. And along with another law was, particularly in New York, and many people may be surprised, but New York had the largest, one of the largest slave populations, you know, as Imani was so talking about yesterday, was that you cannot, if you were enslaved, you cannot meet in groups of three. That was considered heresy. That was considered heresy and punishable by lashing. So within that, within this, these kind of cultural pressure cookers, right, of stripping away people's heritage, there were certain means in which people began to engage their own culture and reverse a lot of culture. So they took the drum away, but they did other things, right? Which is a lot of times, which was they used other percussional instruments, right? They used obviously the clap, you know? And anyone who's familiar with the church, you know, knows how, you know, they saw kind of... Right, moving in polyrhythms, right? Other techniques, and I was looking for a broom, I couldn't find it, was in the Georgia Sea Islands, where they used the broomstick in the churches as a percussion instrument, so boom, 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 as part of their worship, right? Another one, obviously, if anyone's familiar with it, has anyone ever seen Drumline? Or one of those movies? Or like, you know, familiar with, like, you know, the black fraternities, whatever, the step, you know, they do that. And anyone who's familiar with, like, I know, who works in the urban school system or is bored endlessly by the teachers like I was in high school, knows that, you know, knows about, you know, in the cafeteria, they'd be like, and like, the whole entire cafeteria would be like banging because everyone's banging on tables, you know. So these are all what I would say symbols of cultural memory from, you know, the African experience that's been passed down and very much coded. And part of that code was came out through, you know, the great religious revivals of the 17th century and the 18th century. There's a period called the Great Awakening, where thousands of Baptists, Anabaptists, and Methodists flooded the South, you know, and then the creation of the African Methodist Church and the, you know, the Black Baptist Church, certainly. You can look at the work of C. Eric Lincoln in relation to that. Actually, no, E. Franklin Frazier, excuse me. So these kind of democratic movements began, these kind of movements started coming up. And out of this, out of these pressure cookers, and out of these experiences, that this new music began to emerge. And as the music and the music began to emerge, there was a sense of cultural identity that came with it. You know, and we had changed as a people. We became a new people. You know, we became, you know, African Americans in a certain sense. I don't say that in any patriotism. Anyone who knows me says I don't say that in any patriotism. I say African American because that's my condition. You know what I'm saying? It's a condition that was forced upon me. You know what I'm saying? Forced upon my ancestors, rather. So out of this, and out of these experiences, you know, first came, you know, the blues, you know, which, you know, came out with kind of like, you know, came out with the using of hollering and shouting. And out of that, the New Orleans movement in terms of jazz. Now, I'm kind of trying to, I can kind of go in and out about, you know, what the origins of jazz was. You know, I think it was safe to say that, you know, most people identify it as something that came out of New Orleans. You know, I think that it came out of a lot of
Creole,
chamber music. Because you have to understand also that, you know, our image of enslaved Africans, and the reason I use that term enslaved Africans rather than slaves is because I just want to explain real quickly, is that it donated a process of enslavement, but also the fact that it acknowledges the fact that we were a people before we came here, so they didn't go to Africa to get slaves. They went to Africa to get farmers, musicians, metal workers, you know, healers, and we transplanted that knowledge here. It changed, but nonetheless, it was transplanted. And that's why I use the term enslaved Africans, and it's important to note because not only were enslaved Africans engaged in agriculture work, picking cotton, tobacco, what have you, they were also engaged in, like, the skilled trades in terms of, like, shipbuilding. And in some cities, they were also musicians. They would perform. You know what I'm saying? If there was a cotillion or something like that, they would perform. So out of this kind of pressure cooker, you know, came out, you know, these all these cultural forces that came out of it, various experiences, you know, certainly experience with Native American people, such experiences engaging with European classical music, you know, came out the birth of jazz, right? And the word jazz is kind of controversial, and because what Langston Hughes and Robert Ferris Thompson, who's a Yale art professor, identified the word jazz as coming out of the word jism, which means
jazzing,
like,
off.
Yeah, jazzing off, exactly, jazzing off, jism, you know, which suggests is, like, you know, a life force, you know, and a very much an erotic type of movement, you know, and it may have come out of, like, a lot of people like to say, well, it came out of, like, you know, the experiences of, like, jazz was played at brothels or whatever, you know, I have questions about that, but, you know, that's something we can go into detail in the question and answer. If more people have information on that, definitely. So we have this birth of, you know, we have this birth of jazz, various movements, you know, Dixieland, you know, everyone's probably seen the pictures of, like, people with big trombones and, like, hats and, you know, striped suits and playing a corny music or whatever. So, you know, I don't think it's corny, but some people do. You know, and then moving onwards to the big band era, obviously, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, you know, became the life force of the Harlem Renaissance movement. And certainly the period of departure that I want to gauge in is the late 1940s. A couple of things happened in the mid-40s that kind of bear into our discussion of jazz, right? One was, obviously, the dropping of the atomic bomb and the use of atomic energy, you know, and the idea of this new modern moment within society that, and also I should just also mention this really quickly, speaking of modernism, that jazz was obviously very influential in the 1920s in Paris, you know, like the artists like Picasso, you know, in this country, Jacob Lawrence, you know, Augusta Savage, you know, all kind of uses a backdrop because it offered a certain sense of newness, you know, that kind of fit into sort of a modern, you know, a kind of a modernist stance against the world, a war that was reacting against the World War One to the bloodshed, to kind of like the confusion, you know, the famous poem of Yeats, you know, things fall apart, the centers cannot hold. So in this post-World War II period, what we have is we have the atomic age, right? The age of airplanes, the age of speed. And out of this becomes this new playing called bebop, right? Which really comes out, you know, really comes out with really quick dissonance, chord breakage, and speed. And, you know, and obviously that was represented by a number of individuals, including Charlie Parker, obviously Dizzy Gillespie, and also Ella Fitzgerald, who, you know, who, if anyone listens to any Ella Fitzgerald album, knows that she used the mouth as an instrument, you know, saying in terms of really producing different types of sounds. So, out of this kind of speed, we begin to see also that within the jazz moment, within the jazz age, we notice that the same type of repression that happened against enslaved Africans in the 18th, 19th, 20th century is happening again within jazz musicians, particularly with the law. And this is very important for, you know, anarchists and anti-authoritarians to think about, is that as jazz becomes popularized, it becomes the symbol of what's wrong with the city. And if you were a jazz musician, say, in the late 1940s, you couldn't just go play at a club. You needed a what they call a cabaret card, a cabaret license. And one of the tools of control, obviously, by the state was to deny you your cabaret card. So they can say, well, you know what, you know, for example, people like Charlie Parker got busted. He couldn't play. He had to go up to Westchester. Same thing with Thelonious Monk. He couldn't play in New York for 10 years. There's like a whole entire like albums of him in Westchester, you know, where he had to play outside of it. You know, so you had this kind of state repression going on, you know, obviously also Billie Holiday as well, you know. So all the state repression is going on and stuff like that. But still the music is continuing. It's representing a new formulation, a new movement, you know, in terms of looking at art, science, and just thinking in a different way. And it becomes the soundtrack of this kind of like insurgent rebellion within America, you know, that's kind of like on the outskirts, right? And if you think about the jazz cultures that people produce out of that, you got to think of people like Malcolm X, who was very much involved in going to the Audubon Ballroom or the Roseland. If anyone's read the autobiography of Malcolm X, he goes into like him hanging out with Lionel Hampton, you know. So these are all sort of movements that are going on, right? 1949, something else happens as well, which was the invention of the LP, Now, I'm kind of old, you know, I was born in 1976, you know what I'm saying? So I feel like, you know, when I say, I still say records, like kids say today, say CDs, I'm like, oh, you got a new record. And like, what are you talking about? You know what I'm saying? Like, I love that album. I'm like, no. Well, the album is a very recent invention, right? The way we know the album, right? The LP. It came out in 1949 by Columbia Records. And again, what the LP did, which stands for long play, it extended the time. So you didn't have to, because most times the records in the 20s and the 30s were made on the cylinder discs, so they can like be broken easily, and you can only have 3 minutes of playing time on them. So it was a very much a single culture. Like, he had to, okay, you have to do this one thing. But now with the LP, you can have 30 minutes of music on one side. And again, you have this concept of time again kind of being broken down. And the jazz musicians in particular began taking advantage of that, because also with the LP, there was another invention too, the two-track recorder. You know, a lot of us may have it in our parents' house. I know I still have mine, you know. And, you know, my parents were just like, my mother always tells me my father was so happy when he got his two-track recorder, you know, because he get 4 hours of, like, uncontinued listening, you know. Like, wow, you know. But, like, what with that, what can happen is that the studio was taken away from the actual record companies, and you can make a studio in your home. If anyone's familiar with Rudy Van Gelder, he was a famous jazz producer with Blue Note Records. And he was one of the most pioneering individuals in terms of really creating stereo sound and stereophonics within jazz music. And people used to go to his house and say, I have this idea in my head, you know, I want to play it. And he was like, okay, I'll record it. And they would play the idea in his head, and that'll be it. And most times it was just for free or whatever, but that accessibility to that technology transformed what people started playing. All right? So again, that idea of time with the LP, right? Another example I want to give is the demise of the big band, right? The big band, you know, everyone's probably seen pictures of a Count Basie's band, Duke Ellington's band, happening in the early 50s, late 50s. You know, they became more of a touring band, touring, you know, post World War II Europe. But in the States, since it was mostly jazz clubs, you obviously can't really fit a huge jazz band of jazz clubs. The units became much smaller. So you started having like quartets, quintets, you know, trios, and the like. And within that, you began to start having multiple players and musicians, right? So for example, like, you know, if you're a big band, I'm like, Lex, hit it. You come out with the trombone, you stand up, you're like, you know what I'm saying? You know, now, you know, Lex, you know, has got a trombone, and he's got a trumpet, and you might have a flute too. And this is the birth of, like, you know, of an individual, a couple of individuals I want to mention, and I kind of want to take a break right now, if you want to do some listening, if that's okay, is two individuals. One is Rossan Roland Kirk, and the other is Eric Dolphy, you know? And, you know, and what the point I want to make about this is that, you know, keeping within the idea of anti-authoritarian imagination is that by having individuals as multiple instrumentalists, you're actually breaking down that Taylorism again of, like, the individual just doing one thing. Now the individual can do multiple things, you know, and do multiple playing. So I'm going to play a little Rossan Roland Kirk, if you don't mind. Now, believe it or not, Rossan, anyone familiar with Rossan Roland Kirk, he not only played multiple instruments, but he played them all at the same time. So in this album, he's playing actually the song called Domino. He's playing the saxophone and the flute at the same time.
How do you do that?
I'm going to talk to you in a second. I'll tell you in a second.
Thank you. listen for a second. Just gonna pause for the cause. That's from the Domino album, Rashawn Roland Kirk. Right. You know, so and he used to come out with these huge, like anyone see a picture of him, he used to have these like maybe like four saxophones on him, and like a penny whistle, and like, you know, and he used to like, you know, take the two, and he's and also I should add, he was disabled, like he was blind. You know what I'm saying? And you know, and so he was calling this. Like, I mean, you got to see a film of this guy. In fact, I think I'm probably going to try to write a biography of him. There hasn't been one come out yet. But amazing, amazing musician. And what he did was, like, obviously, again, he was like a one-man band by himself. So the technical innovations, the changing of individuals from a single player to multiple players, particularly with Eric Dolphy, and I was just like Outward Bound. I forgot to bring the album Outward Bound, but you know, Eric Dolphy played alto, flute, and what else did he play? What do you call it?
Bass clarinet.
Thank you, bass clarinet. Yeah, bass clarinet. You know, really revisiting.
But not at the same time.
Not exactly. Not at the same time. Not like Rashawn Roland Kirk. Not at the same time. You know, so you see these kind of technical innovations, right? Obviously, in the post-war period as well, you know, there's political stuff going on. You know what I'm saying? There's the Bandung Conference. You know what I'm saying? The meeting of third world nations. There's an anti-colonial movement that's heating up in African Asia. You know, that China had just, you know, got its independence. You know, whether, you know, we agree with the political direction or not is a significant development. You know, and also just got the bomb. So there's this idea of, you know, you know, and to use a Du Boisian term, you know, the colored nations of the world on the march, you know. And this obviously influenced, you know, musicians here because they began to look more inwardly and outwardly towards Africa and towards Asia, you know. And it's also the fact that, you know, the U.S. the State Department also helped in that effort because the State Department began to send all these, like, jazz musicians, you know, and say, you know, the United States is not so bad. You know, they just start sending like lengthy
studies program.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like the Congress of Cultural Freedom was like a CIA front
to divide the world up into spheres of influence.
Exactly. You know, so yeah, like individuals like Langston Hughes, Louis Armstrong, Randy Weston, you know, Max, they're all going to Africa to perform at these newly independent nations. You know what I'm saying? They give the idea that, you know, we too are, you know, all this, you know. You know, at the same time, of course, you have Malcolm in the United States, Malcolm X in the United States saying, you know, that this is bullshit, you know what I'm saying, and talking to the UN, and mind you, the UN is a relatively new phenomenon at this period of time, you know, saying to these nations, saying, that, you know, we need international solidarity, because in the United States, you know, during the civil rights movement, the African Americans have no rights in the United States, right? So you have these contrasts going on, and the jazz musicians begin to take it up. And I wanted to stay with Malcolm for a second because I think it's important to look at Malcolm, the popularity of Malcolm in the Nation of Islam, because a lot of jazz musicians begin to take up Islam as a religion, and it becomes much more of a, you know, Middle Eastern, East Asian, and also South Asian influence within the music. You know, and obviously that was kind of personified in John Coltrane. You know, and I want to talk a little about John Coltrane. Before I talk about John Coltrane, how am I doing with time? Speaking of, of course. Huh? What time is it? Obviously, you know, I don't.
10 after 2.
10 after 2. How long is it?
Before you get into Coltrane, could you say something? I just read recently that Art Blakey and a lot of his band members had a strong connection to Islam. Do you know anything about what form of Islam they were following?
Yeah, Art Blakey was a Muslim. You know what I'm saying? He had the name of Bahamni, I believe it is, and also McCoy Tyner.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying? And while the public didn't really know this, it was kind of a private thing, as well as Max Roach. You know what I'm saying? So you have individuals like Max Roach, you know, Art Blakey. Thank you for mentioning Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, another awesome percussion-based band. Art Blakey was a drummer. that all kind of embrace Islam at that particular moment in time, you know? Can I take any other questions or any other?
So was it more traditional Middle Eastern Islam, or was it some kind of hybrid? Or did you know anything about the form of Islam?
Well, I know with Art Blakey, it was a traditional form of Islam, you know, and it's an interesting book. There's a book called The African American Experience, Islam in Black America, that goes into like tracing the Islamic roots in Black America all the way to like, you know, the 19th century, you know. So it was a traditional form of Islam. Now with someone like Max Roach, was actually a member of the Nation of Islam. You know, and I think, does anyone actually understand like differences, like somewhat differences that Nation of Islam, commonly, you know, referred to as Black Muslims, you know, founded by Elijah Muhammad, you know, whereas, you know, some Muslims were like, you know, more traditional, you know, and the Black Muslims more into political rights as well as, you know, spiritual, you know, did a lot of work in prisons and stuff like that. Yeah.
And bow ties,
and bean pies. Right. Yeah.
There are also, I think, Some slaves, people, enslaved Africans mm-hmm. from West Africa brought over were already Muslim.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm, exactly, and that's a good point, because like, there's actually, I wish I had brought the book, but if we look at the African American experience, Islam in America, they talk about, you know, the enslaved Africans who were also Muslim, a lot of times they brought their own freedom. You know what I'm saying? Instead of their own mosques. You know what I'm saying? And it had a very autonomous subculture, you know what I'm saying, within the United States. You know, that needs to be documented a little bit more. I want to play a little bit of John Coltrane. This is actually from the brass, we call it the Complete Africa Brass album. You know, and this composition is called Africa. Its actual composition is about 20 minutes long. I'm going to only play about three, maybe two. And then I'm going to kind of like, do a few other things, and I'm going to start having some discussion. There's also with Eric Dolphy. Jimmy Garrison and Reggie Workman on bass. Get a kind of idea. Yeah, you have a,
what recording is that?
That's from the Complete Brass.
Africa
Brass. Thank you.
Africa Brass.
Yeah, John Coltrane.
I was wondering if you'd talk a little more at some point in time about cool jazz and the reaction.
Well, I was just getting to that.
To bebop. And
yeah, I was just going to get to that. I'm glad you mentioned that. Because after I played this, because obviously there's a reaction to...
And also how, like, it, Miles Davis tried to go back into, like, non... what is it? Non-tonal music?
Right.
Modal music.
Right. I'm definitely... That's going to be next. I got On the Corner ready. Okay. I'm going to address that in 1 second. Before I get into that, I want to kind of get an idea. What did people hear when they heard that? I mean, what impressions did they get in terms of the beginning and the limited amount? I mean, what kind of story, if it was a story, what kind of story would it be? What do you hear?
Literally, what kind of story?
What impressions do you get when listening to that particular?
I mean, I get images. Like, I don't know anything about music.
Go ahead.
I just was seeing, like, kind of people, like, running, and it sounded very, like, nighttime, and kind of people, like, getting away in secret or something.
Okay. Anyone else? That's good. Anyone else want to jump in there?
It sounded kind of angry. Look at that bass line in the beginning.
The bass line, yeah. The bass line's like boom, 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 boom. What about
maybe narrating some kind of motion?
Different. Usually, Coltrane's always way more up front. It sounded like he was way in the back.
Yeah,
there's a lot of reverb.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Anyone else want to jump in? There's no correct answer, there's no correct answer, you know what I'm saying? But definitely, given the title Africa, and, in the slowly rising bass line that, you mentioned, and also by the different horns, because he used the two orchestras in it, there's this sort of sense of this underlying conflict, within it, And later on, it gets a little bit more louder, in the middle of it. And what's interesting also is that the bass and the drums are more pronounced, than anything else. So it's a much more earthy beat, And it's much more, Elvin Jones is like kind of, you get a bass much more. So it's kind of like tied to the earth, tied to motion, tied to people kind of get ready. I always like to hear that first line that I hear. I always think of it as an elephant, Like roaring. That's why I always get that's my image I always get. And I was wondering if that was the kind of like, elephant, like at nighttime, like you said, kind of do that. And also the motion and stuff like that, too. Right? And like, so just really quickly, and like kind of like Sunila mentioned, I'm so glad you mentioned this, Sunila, is that, all this had a reaction, right? And all of a sudden, people are kind of doing this thing, and it's really kind of like people are kind of experimenting with Africa and Islam and, not only that, but also like other Eastern traditions, Buddhism and Hinduism. This kind of reaction, and like one of the biggest reactions that Sunila mentioned is cool jazz. You know what I'm saying? And obviously it's kind of like a derivative of the Cold War. You know what I'm saying? It's like everyone just be cool. You know what I'm saying? And it's kind of like, you have people like Chet Baker, I'm always hating on Chet Baker. I really don't like Chet Baker. I'm sorry. Obviously Miles. And the idea of just like the music being detached from any kind of emotion, any type of feeling, anything that's going on, and these people just being like very much like, this is music. Now I'm not trying to just diss it because like there's a lot of it within it that's very good. Obviously the classic is kind of blue, but it's completely improvisational and really interesting. Obviously, Coltrane's on that as well. So the music's kind of changing. And it's interesting how this kind of music was kind of popularized in the 50s during the whole time McCarthy era, during the whole time era of the Cold War, where there was kind of a kind of disenchantment and a kind of sense of this like of nullifyingness, in the country. No, nullification within the country. A numbness, rather. But continue on. We'll come back to Miles later on when I talk about like the 70s,
And free jazz,
yeah.
Ornette Coleman.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're gonna get to Well, actually, we're going to start that right now. Let's just jump into it.
I think one of the things is that there were all these movements, like, they overlapped in the sense that, like, Coltrane was involved, you know, or Miles or whoever, they were involved in all these different things, sometimes at the same time. So it wasn't, I don't think they were, like, warring schools of thought.
No, not at all. I mean, everything kind of, like, you think that, you know, a lot of people say, like, you know, all you anarchists, you always go to the same conference, you see the same people. Well, it's the same thing with the jazz. No, it's not the same because people, it's not so much as the sameness, but it's the relationships you build, right? You know, and that's the most important thing. It's not about the quantity of new people you meet, but the relationships you have with old people and the people you know over years that makes a political movement even better, right? Same thing with music, right? If you know, you don't want to bring someone in who you just met off the street sometimes, you know? And Coltrane did it because he wanted to give people opportunities. We'll get to that in a second when Coltrane went avant-garde, so to speak. But, you know, Miles played with Thelonious Monk, you know what I'm saying? You know, Monk played with Coltrane, you know what I'm saying? Obviously, the long-standing sessions they had at the Five Spot, you know, for almost a year. And also, a lot of the sidemen kind of worked, you know, within different groups. So it's like everyone kind of did their own different thing, and everyone kind of had more of a different style, you know? And one of the reactions in terms of getting back to Coltrane a little bit was that Coltrane came out of Miles, but a lot of people reacted to Coltrane differently because he was always reacting to the cool jazz. Like, Coltrane could never really play cool, you know? If you listen to Coltrane on Account of Blue, Coltrane's coming out with these crazy solos. You know what I'm saying? Miles is like, the Coltrane is like, you know what I'm saying? And people are like, Miles, you gotta fire this dude. You know what I'm saying? This motherfucker's fucking it up for everybody. You know what I'm saying? But then Coltrane comes out with the seminal album, and I wish I put it up there, Giant Steps. You know what I'm saying? And the Giant Steps album, like, was the first really for myself when the major contributions to a post bebop moment. Because what Giant Steps did was that it played with not only speed, but with ferocity, with power. You know what I'm saying? And that's the thing with Coltrane was very interesting, is that Coltrane began to play with this kind of power and really taking the soloist to the next level. You know, I wish I had bought that album. It's an awesome album. I want to get a little into like, but kind of returning back to the theme of the Third World, the reason I'm kind of examining Coltrane's body in such a depth, because I think that within it, he kind of represented a sort of globalness that was going on in society. You know, if you talk about Dr. King being influenced by Mahatma Gandhi, you know, certainly Coltrane's influences with the Indian modal music, you know, found in My Favorite Things, really began to really speak to a new sense of global possibility within the music.
You mean Hindustani classical music?
You're right. He was good friends with Ravi Shankar, you know, and wanted to study under Ravi Shankar and have music together. You know, unfortunately, it never happened because he died so, you know, relatively young, in the age of 39, 1967. You know, but if you listen to My Favorite Things, you know, and like, you know, My Favorite Things is like, anyone seen The Sound of Music?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
You know,
Trap Family Singers up the street.
Exactly. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It has a kind of like the German feel to it, okay? I'm not trying to hate on the Germans. You know?
It's Swiss.
It's Swiss. But I was thinking it's German. Oh, it's the Nazis were after them. That's why. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, the Highlands, the Hinterlands. You know? So, but then when you listen to like Coltrane's version, it's like, dun, dun. You know, it's much more freer, right? And you know, and he plays with another instrument that hasn't been seen in years, a soprano saxophone. You know, so he's doing this Eric Dolphy thing. He's bringing in the saxophone and, you know, a different musician. So he's bringing a soprano and a tenor. Same time, you know, he hires Eric Dolphy as a sideman. You know, and they begin to produce, and one of the best, you know, albums, you know, I hate this album, I'm not sounding like Commercial Impulse Records, but one of the best albums, of course, is, you know, Coltrane Live at the Village Vanguard, where he does his thing of India, you know what I'm saying, which is like, you know, Eric Dolphy playing on the bass line, and, you know, Coltrane playing on top with with the soprano saxophone. Now, of course, again, we have state intervention or whatever in the words of the critics. Because the critics are like, this isn't jazz. You know, these are the same people that didn't like Charlie Parker. But now they're saying, this is anti-jazz. This is not jazz. This is not real good music. And if you want to listen to good music,
it's not tonal.
Yeah, it's not tonal. You know, and it's, you know, you should, you know, and this Coltrane, again, with the time, because Coltrane was to stretch out 35 minutes on a solo, you know, and just like, you know, apparently, you know, according to Rashid Ali, like, he would play a 35 minute solo, go back to the dressing room and still be playing, come back and play again. You know what I'm saying? And like, and be sweating and just be like, you know, whatever, right? So there was this whole time movement called the quote unquote anti-jazz movement, and it was really reflected in terms of like, you know, magazines like Downbeat, you know, and also the Newport Jazz Festival, and I want to kind of get into that a little bit because like, again, you have this great music, this music that's being produced by, you know, mostly black people, almost all black people, but the people who own the record companies, obviously, you know, say are the big capitalists, you know, saying, you know, and I want to say it's all white because the guy who owned Atlantic Records, his name is Ahmed Ergot, I think his name?
Erdogan,
yeah, thank you. You know what I'm saying? He was very influential in bringing Coltrane into Atlantic Records and a lot of other musicians as well. So you have, like, for example, you have like the Newport Jazz Festival, right? The biggest jazz festival, you know, still going on, you know? And, like, everyone's got to kind of play it, you know? And a group of musicians kind of got together and were like, listen, you know, you know, we're suffering because, like, these record companies are making millions and millions of dollars of jazz. And this is a time when jazz is selling millions of copies, you know. They're, like, they're making these millions and millions of dollars. And, like, you know, I'm...